moons. Ceres, the largest of them, is barely 1,000 kilometers across. Put all the millions of asteroids together and they wouldn't amount to a body as large as Earth's moon, Victor knew. Some belt, he thought. More like an enormous football stadium with only a few dozen people scattered among the seats. No time for philosophy, Victor told himself sternly. See where you are and how quick you can get back to the ship. He began running through the navigational computer's data. The pod's thruster had fired him off roughly in the direction of Ceres, while Syracuse, with Pauline and the kids in it, had been accelerating in the opposite direction, toward the belt's outer fringes. Not good, he thought. Not good at all. The pod had no real propulsion system, only the rocket thruster that had hurled it clear of the ship once he'd fired the explosive bolts to separate from Syracuse. He had small coal gas jets for fine maneuvering, but no engine that could turn him around and head him back to the ore carrier. Okay, he said to himself, then where am I heading? Again, the news was not good. The pod was on a trajectory that would miss Ceres by several thousand kilometers. Not that there was anything or anybody left at Ceres who could help him. Chrysalis was destroyed, and its rock rat inhabitants slaughtered. The few ore carriers and smelter ships that had been in orbit around Ceres must have lit off and fled out of there as fast as they could. Besides, he said aloud, I don't have any communications that could reach them. I'm deaf and mute. No sense moaning, he told himself. Find out where in hell you are and where you're heading. He ran through the navigation program twice, then a third time. The numbers did not change. The control pod was coasting through space sunward. It would miss Ceres by exactly 17.9 thousand kilometers and continue sailing inward past the orbit of Mars, which was all the way over on the other side of the sun now, then past the orbits of Earth, Venus, and Mercury. It looked as if he would miss running into the sun and instead would swing around it and start heading outward again, if he didn't broil first as he approached the sun's searing brilliance. His outbound course would bring him back almost to the exact spot where he'd separated the pod from Syracuse, in roughly 4.5 years. Victor didn't bother to calculate the perturbations on his course that the gravitational fields of the inner planets would cause. Why bother? Long before he reached even Mars's orbit, he'd be dead of starvation. Of course, if the pod's cranky air recycler crapped out, he could die of asphyxiation long before that.
In Syracuse's backup command pod, Theo felt like screaming or pounding his gloved fists against the control board. He had carefully switched on the pod's electrical power, then booted up the control instruments and sensors one at a time to make certain he didn't overload the system and trip any circuits. Now he stared at the red lights glaring at him from one end of the panel to the other. Propulsion fuel tanks, air reserve tanks, structural integrity. All in the red. The fusion reactor and main engine were undamaged, apparently, but the level of hydrogen fuel left in the battered tanks was dangerously, critically low. The fusion reactor generated the ship's electrical energy and powered the main engine. At the rate the engine was roaring along now, the tanks would be totally dry in hours. Theo shut down the main engine. We're going to need that H2 for electrical power, he thought. We can coast for the time being. Dad had us going like a bat out of Hades to get us away from that murdering son of a female dog. He began to use the cameras on the ship's tiny maintenance robots to assess the damage to the ship's structure. God, she's falling apart, he whispered to himself. When the attacker slagged the antennas, his laser beams sliced through the hull of that section of the wheel, gutting their main propulsion fuel tanks. Penetrated through to the tunnels, too, Theo saw. That's how we lost the air in there. Sitting in the command chair, Theo realized that Syracuse was badly damaged and heading deeper into the belt, away from Ceres, away from any chance of help. The antennas are gone. Our fuel is down to a couple of days' worth. We're going to lose electrical power and die. For the first time since he'd been a baby, Theo wanted to cry. He wanted to curl up into a fetal ball and let his fate overtake him. But that would mean Mom and Angie would die, too. He lifted his chin a notch. It's up to me, he told himself. I've got to repair this damage. Angie can't do it, not by herself anyways. I've got to get this ship back in operating condition and heading toward civilization. I've got to keep Mom and Angie alive. He thought that his father would know what to do and how to do it. But Dad's gone. There's nobody here but me. It's up to me now, he said aloud.
Or ship Syracuse, lavatory. Angela stepped out of the shower stall, vigorously rubbing a towel over her body. As she tucked it around her and wrapped a second towel over her wet hair, she muttered something. Pauline was at the sink brushing her teeth. The mirror was fogging from the steam of her daughter's shower. She rubbed a clear spot with a hand towel as Angela finished drying herself. It's not fair, Angela muttered again. Pauline rinsed her mouth, then asked, What's not fair? Theo's got a lav all to himself while we're bumping into each other in here. Theo shared the other lav with your father when he was here, Pauline said. Still, it's not fair. He ought to... Pauline silenced her daughter with a stern glance. Angela, you've got to stop fighting with your brother.
Me?
She seemed genuinely shocked.
He's the one who's always calling me names, yelling that I boss him around. I'm the older one. He ought to be taking orders from me.
Young lady, Pauline said, the way she always did when she was about to tell her daughter something Angela didn't want to hear. I will say this only once more. I want you to stop arguing with Theo. He's had an enormous burden of responsibility dumped on his shoulders.
Me too.
Yes, I know. But Theo's a male, and he automatically assumes he's got to take charge.
That's dumb.
Maybe it is. But you and I will have to deal with it. Thee would welcome help from you if only you'd be pleasant about it and stop calling him names.
I don't,
Angela. You're the older sibling. It's up to you to set the tone between you and your brother. I will not have you two bickering over every little thing that comes up. We're in enough danger here. We all need to work together if we're going to survive. Angela sagged back onto the edge of the sink.
Are we really in that much trouble?
Yes. We are. She stared down at her bare toes for several moments. Then, in a low voice, Do you think Dad really ran away?
Not for a picosecond, Pauline said firmly. He lured that attacker away from us. He saved our lives.
Do you think he got killed? Pauline had to pull in a breath before she could reply, No.
Really, Ma? Really and truly?
Really and truly, my little angel. He's not dead. I know it in my bones. He's out there somewhere trying to find us. Trying to save us.
Angela threw her arms around her mother's neck.
I'll be good, Ma, I promise, she said tearfully.
I'll treat Theo better, you'll see.
I know, Pauline said, holding her daughter in her arms. I know. That night, as she slipped into her oversized bed, alone, Pauline thought that she should have a talk with Theo as well. It takes two to make a fight. Angela's not the only one who needs to improve her behavior. She turned out the lights and lay back on her pillow. The bed seemed empty, lonely, without Victor beside her.
He's not dead, Pauline told herself. He left us to decoy that attacker away from us, to save us from being destroyed. He got away. I know he did. I'd know if he were dead. I'd feel it, somehow.
Pauline Osgood Zacharias was made of strong fiber. Born in Cellini, while her astronomer parents were teaching at the university there, she had grown up in the sunless corridors and confined living quarters of that underground city. To Pauline, the outdoors meant strolling along the winding pathways of Cellini's Grand Plaza, beneath its arching concrete dome, admiring the miniature trees and shrubbery that the lunar citizens so lovingly tended. She was 15 before her parents allowed her to go without them out onto the surface.